the burning has stopped. Yet we know that the injury is far from over. For instance, a person who has been unfortunate enough to suffer a burn on his or her face and who is noticeably scarred as a result will tell you that it changes how they feel about their adequacy. They become far more uncertain about going out into the world. In other words, the same disfigurement they have suffered physically has also affected their psyche. If there is a visible scar on their face, they may well say, "I cannot and will not go out there and present myself." Suppose that a person has suffered some traumatic injury that leaves no physical scars. Perhaps a trusted relative molested them. Maybe they were verbally assaulted by a parent or betrayed by a person they had come to rely on as a friend. Perhaps as a young child, they watched helplessly as some horrible tragedy unfolded before their eyes. Again, the incident itself may have ended in a flash. From the moment the injury began until it ended may have taken less time than it takes to snap your fingers. Yet what happens to that person's self-concept, their psyche? It is wounded, scarred, disfigured. If a traumatic event of this kind has happened in your life, you may be living just as if your skin had been burned. Unlike a physical scar, psychic disfigurement is visible only to a public of one, and that is you. You may be responding to an invisible scar just as you would a visible one, by avoiding the world, by shying away from competition and participation, by withdrawing into the shadows of reticence and self-consciousness. You may be living a life that is dispirited and passive. The point is that psychic disfigurement may be just as crippling and debilitating to your self-concept as physical disfigurement would be. Admittedly, there are other factors that influence your self-concept, particularly the internal factors that we will address shortly. You must know, however, that every chain has a first link. And in the chain of an evolving self-concept, that first link is almost assuredly an external interactive one. Prepare to be enlightened by examining the first links in your life chain. Let's go back to the very beginning of your life chain. A huge defining moment of overwhelming significance for you was the moment of your birth. You didn't get a vote, it just happened. One day, there you were. You became part of a long chain, its links consisting of your parents, your grandparents, and your siblings. All you had, all you knew, all you had available to you was what your parents, siblings, extended family, and life station offered up to you. Chains create momentum. Obviously, your existing life chain is a huge programmer of what your radar will pick up. You scan information consistent with what your life chain has taught you about you and your possibilities, or the lack thereof. For example, if you get fired and interpret that as a personal failure, you will now internalize that perception and be more inclined to pick up other failure-type messages. You'll be less inclined to pick up success-type messages. Your radar goes into confirm-only mode as it scans the landscape of your life looking for information that will make you right, even if it makes you unhappy. Researchers have demonstrated this experience-based, self-limiting tendency in every organism you can imagine. They have even documented it with a bunch of fleas. But unlike fleas, you don't have to just mindlessly go along with the life chain you have both inherited and passively contributed to. You can begin to shape its links actively and consciously. Now, I'm not going to give you a new personal truth or a new authentic self-concept because I don't have to. What you need is there. It's always been there. It's just been buried so deep you didn't know how to access it. Your personal truth, your self-concept, just needs to be cleaned up and rid of all the junk and misinformation that you have internalized for so many years. If you keep listening, you soon will know exactly how to do just that. When I was in the fifth grade, my family and I lived in a tidy little neighborhood in the suburbs of Denver, Colorado. Nobody on our street was high society. just a lot of small tract houses, but it was a quiet, comfortable environment. New school, people swapping stories on the porch after dinner, and everybody's house was the same. 3 bedrooms, 1 bath, and a single car garage. School was humming along pretty well for me that year. I had a close-knit group of friends, was making pretty good grades, and had found my passion in athletics. In fact, sports were becoming the big deal for me. I found that I was comfortable in the thick of competition. As the school year drew to a close, I was awarded Athlete of the Year, together with the award for sportsmanship. Very affirming events for me, because it was the first time I had ever won anything, except for a Mexican hat dance ribbon I got in the 4th grade. I won that for getting less dizzy than my partner Linda Snyder, who later came up behind me, hit me between the shoulder blades, and proceeded to beat the crap out of me for making her look bad. At the very least, I was feeling pretty good about school in general, and the 5th grade in particular. Looking back, I have to say this was a time of real innocence for me. I had no problems to speak of, other than turning my back on the she-wolf, Linda. I've come to learn that for most of us, the events that shape our lives are typically events that, but for our personal stake, are of little interest and of little drama. But once you add that element of personal involvement and personal impact, once you add that relevancy, events that barely even hit the rest of the world's radar screen take on considerable significance. Remember, if it's important to you, then it's important, period. What was about to happen to me would hardly be noticed by anyone not personally involved, but it would shape a part of my self-concept to this very day. Now, according to my mom, I've never, ever started a fight in my life. But also attending our little school that year were some kids who had all lived together in a rough neighborhood several blocks away from my house. They were in the 6th grade, just a year older than I was, but a foot taller and a foot broader, or so it seemed. One day at recess, these 6th graders from hell, as we called them, started picking on a bunch of the younger, smaller kids, including me and a couple of my buddies. The verbal abuse escalated, and then a couple of them grabbed my friend Michael by the neck, got him in a headlock, and threw him to the ground. They started pushing and shoving the rest of us all at the same time. I don't remember a whole lot after that. I mean, I remember hitting one of them in the face with a basketball as hard as I could. I remember hitting one with a swing. My dad always said, "Son, if they're bigger than you, just pick up some difference and even things out a little bit." No one involved was big enough to really do any damage, but to all of us, it was an epic battle of indescribable proportions. I didn't start it, but I can remember being fairly passionate about finishing it. Eventually, we were hauled into the principal's office, and my homeroom teacher was summoned. As I stood there at the judgment seat, my nose bleeding, my shirt ripped, chunks of gravel embedded in my cheek, and with a huge knot on my forehead, I recall feeling a sense of relief. I was relieved that Mrs. Johnson, who, of all the adults at the school, knew me the best, was coming to my aid. Knowing what she did about my character, my sportsmanship award, my loyalty to my friends, and my peaceful nature, there could be no doubt that she would quickly get to the bottom of it all and would speak up for me before the principal. What happened next was a defining moment in my life. Mrs. Johnson walked in, she looked at the principal, she looked down at me, and she flew into a rage. For the first few moments of her tirade, I couldn't even make out what she was saying. I was astonished. Apparently, she was humiliated that one of her students had been in a fight. The verbal abuse I had just heard on the playground was nothing compared to what she heaped on me. She never stopped to ask what had happened. She made it clear that she didn't care what happened. She just blistered me with a torrent of angry words. Some of those words I will never forget. "Oh, you're Mr. Tough Guy, aren't you?" she said. "You don't take guff off of anybody, do you?" Didn't she realize how big those kids were? Didn't she know what they had done? Didn't she owe it to me at least to ask what happened? At first, I was stunned and hurt. Then, it was as if something clicked in me. I saw with sudden clarity that Mrs. Johnson was not my friend at all. I saw that far from taking up her responsibility to protect me from bullies and find out the truth, she was going to protect herself first. She had an agenda for me that ignored my safety and my well-being. It ignored my need to be who I was to myself and my friends. The message was clear. Don't you make waves in my world, young man. You do whatever I need and expect you to do to not complicate my life. To hell with yours. In a flash, it hit me right there in the principal's office that I could no longer assume that life was fair. It was not fair. It was not objective. It became clear to me that the person I had to look to was me. The only person who had my back was me. Inside, I was saying, "What are you thinking, lady? Have you gone insane?" But what I said aloud was, "No, you're right. I don't take guff from anybody, and that includes you." The principal immediately suspended me from school for 3 days, earning him a prominent place on my enemy list. That singular event, that defining moment that I labeled as betrayal, would prove to change who I was inside. Call it the death of innocence, the maturing beyond naivete, or just a wake-up call that the world was not my personal oyster, but it changed who I was inside. In that 5-minute span, the world wrote on the slate of Phil McGraw. Was it a big deal? Probably not to Miss Johnson or the principal, or to those sixth graders who spent half of their school year in the detention hall, but it was to me. To me, it was a defining moment, as real and immediate as anything I've ever experienced. Now, in the span of your life, not every moment can be recalled and singled out. Nevertheless, just as with me, there have been events, moments in your life that have defined and redefined who you are. The event enters your consciousness with such power that it confronts the very core of who and what you conceived you were. It is no exaggeration to say that before such an event occurs, your self-concept is A. After it occurs, your self-concept is B. A part of you is replaced or modified by that piece of your history, something new that will always be with you. You will forever after define yourself to some degree by your experience of that event. As I look back at my own defining moment in elementary school, I can see pretty clearly how that episode altered my concept of self. I recognize the consequences that it had in my life. First of all, it should not be surprising to learn that I have always been leery of those who are in a position of authority in my life. That's just become part of who I am. Whether my perception and interpretation of the event was accurate or not, it was real to me. An argument could be made that I deserved at least some of what I got, but to me, at that age, and now for that matter, I don't see it that way, and if it's real to me, then that is reality. Please understand, I have been blessed by some outstanding teachers along the way, and I have always tried to be on guard against making any other teacher or authority figure pay for the shortcomings of Miss Johnson. Whenever I'm asked, "Who are your heroes?" my unhesitating answer is, "Teachers who do it right." Nevertheless, since that episode in Denver, I have never, ever been completely at ease in the academic environment or any other in which someone has assigned authority over me in any way. That now is part of my self-concept. Bottom line, on the continuum that runs from paranoia at one end to naivete at the other end, I'm a good ways from paranoia, but I am absolutely a country mile from naive and accepting. Having been what I believe to have been emotionally violated and betrayed, I am committed to being self-reliant and self-protecting and to never let it happen to me again. I refuse to be helpless. I don't give anybody the benefit of the doubt, and I am fully aware that there is a direct, unbroken connection between that approach to life and what happened to me in grade school. Some of our defining moments are decidedly negative, while others are emphatically positive. The positive moments powerfully affirm our authentic selves, inspiring us with an awareness of our own capabilities. They lift us up to a place from which we can see all kinds of possibilities for ourselves. We take from them the kind of emotional and spiritual energy that can sustain us for a lifetime. I recall another classroom story, one that a very dear friend shared with me one day when I was telling her about this part of the audiobook. I related my harrowing experience of fifth grade, and she said that she had been just as powerfully impacted in the third grade, but in the completely opposite direction. I was so moved by the story that I asked her if she would share it with you. Here is her story as she told it to me. I always liked school because aside from my church, it was the only place as a child growing up that I remember feeling valued. I loved books. They were an escape, a way for me to believe that I could become anybody and do anything. Books presented a possibility to me. So when Ms. Driver, my third grade teacher, assigned us to read Honestly, Katie John, a fifth grade level book, I don't mind telling you, I was mucho excited to take on the challenge. We had 2 weeks to read and turn in our book reports. I was done in less than a week. Miss Driver was so proud of me and my work that she stood before the class and made much ado about it. Of course, this did not fare well with my other classmates who turned on me for supposedly making them look bad. But it didn't stop there. She didn't just compliment me in front of the class. She told everyone, including all the teachers in the teacher's lounge. When I moved on to the fourth grade, a full year later, my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Duncan, said, "Oh, I know you. You're the girl who reads and turns in your work early." Life-altering moment. In that one moment in time, I was changed. I realized that when you work hard, when you do things well, people take notice. People remember you and value you. In my young mind, I also made the important connection that it was only because I had loved the book so much that I found it so easy to do the work and turn it in early. I was so passionate about the book and wanted to be so much like Katie John that I actually went home and tried to give my black girl self some freckles. So, another life-altering moment, another defining moment. Do what you love. Do what you have a passion for, and life becomes so very much easier. The friend that told me that story of third grade passion and clarity was Oprah Winfrey. Oprah says today that it was absolutely one of the proudest and most defining moments of her life. A zest for learning had led her to a definition of self that was based on a powerful connection to a personal truth that had its roots in that classroom. From that point on, she believed that she could do anything if she worked hard. She knew that hard work and creating value by being who and what you authentically were could create respect and great results. As the years passed, she was repeatedly sustained and energized by the recollection of that day the papers were returned. When people told her that she, a black woman from the Deep South, should not even think about pursuing a career as a TV reporter, she remembered that day. When the possibility of her hosting a morning talk show came up and people said, "An overweight black woman with almost no experience? I don't think so." She remembered that day. She recalled that little voice inside the third grade girl that had whispered to her as she sat down to write, "I can do this. I can do this because I love it." She never forgot the lesson that with the determination to put her God-given talent to work, and with the willingness to try as hard as she could accomplish anything. When you think about your capacity for remembering, you probably recognize that that ability is both a gift and a curse. As humans, we are poor historians of fact, but we are superb in emotional history. Memory gives us the ability to travel back in time, but our ability to recall facts is far from accurate. By contrast, we re-experience the feelings connected with an event with extraordinary efficiency. Your and my defining moments are the outlines of our lives. If we do not have even some awareness of them, we are blind to ourselves. When we don't know our defining moments, life becomes unpredictable, irrational, needlessly confusing. We wonder why we do the things we do and hope that tomorrow will be better for us. Although we may know that we've had a bunch of interesting events in our lives and memories of them emerge from time to time, those memories may seem random to us, disconnected from each other and from anything going on in the present. Our attitude becomes, so what? Bottom line, planned or unplanned, remembered or not, you have had defining moments in your life and you must identify them if you expect to reconnect with your authentic self and take control of how you feel about you and what you create in your life. Your defining moments can be the door that opens your authentic self. By that I mean that your defining moments have elicited a response from you, but your response may not be an authentic part of who you are. In fact, your defining moments may have blinded you to your power and strengths by evoking overwhelmingly negative emotions and fear about yourself or the world. It's time to haul your defining moments out into the sunlight. It's time for you to get some bright line, no kidding understanding of what have been the major influences on what you have become and how you think about yourself. In psychological terms, you're about to do some recollecting. You are recollecting when you remember an occasion in terms of at least two ways. First, an incident, and second, a result. You remember falling down, an incident, and the next thing you remember is your mother holding you, a result. You remember the dog biting you, and you cried. You drew a picture, and the teacher told you it was good. By themselves, memories pass quickly. But when they have consequences, they become life stories. It's the consequences, the connections between the incident and the result that make the memories useful. When you feel insecure, you remember the story about falling down. When you're afraid of being alone, you recall the story and the fear of being bitten by the dog. The following exercise is designed to discover what those important stories are for you. Let these questions help you recollect. I have grouped the questions in age brackets so the answers will be easier to remember. But be aware that defining moments are not age specific. Defining moments shape your interactions with the world regardless of when in your life they occur. For this exercise to be useful, you must require of yourself the most detailed and thorough memory you can muster. Physical features and circumstances, as well as thoughts and emotions, must be as clearly described as possible for you to come away with the depth of information that you need. Now, when you're ready to do the exercises, you will need to get some form of journal that can hold many pages of work and that is intended to be totally confidential and for your eyes only. Let me say that again, for your eyes only. Next, find a quiet spot that affords you some privacy, a comfortable place to sit, and some uninterrupted time. In other words, turn off the damn television and send the kids to bed or out to play. Our first category involves the ages of 1 to 5 years old. Typically, recollections of these years and their outcome focus on interactions with other family members or the early trials of growing up, like playing games or learning to sleep in the dark. Now, begin writing about whatever recollections of these years stand out in your mind and heart. We're looking for defining moments, so if you already have a clear target event in mind, go right to it and start answering the questions I'll mention in a moment. If you are not clear on a standout moment, don't assume there aren't any, just start writing and recollecting. You might surprise yourself and discover a moment that you had suppressed or were in denial about. Taking the first moment you have selected, relax and allow your mind's eye to roam freely over all of its details. As you re-experience that incident, let all 5 senses play a part in your search for information. I'm now going to list some questions, and I want you to write them down because we're going to use them for each of the age brackets in your life. Here are the questions. Where are you for this defining moment? How old are you and what do you look like? Who is there with you or who is supposed to be there with you? What is happening that makes this moment so significant? What emotions or changes of emotions are you experiencing at this time? Loneliness, anger, fear, confusion, joy, power, helplessness? How would you change this situation if you could? What is your mental, physical experience? Are you in a mental fog or are you clear-minded? What do you smell, taste, feel? Are you in pain, weak, paralyzed? If you could speak to someone at this moment, who would it be? What would you say? What are you saying to yourself? What do you need right now more than anything else? Once you've written answers to these questions for one important incident during this life stage, then do it for another incident in the same life stage, if there is one. Take whatever time you need to recollect and write down as many of these moments as possible. Then, for each event, answer the following in writing. Again, note these questions because we will use them in each age bracket. Here are the questions. How do you feel now? What emotions are you now having? What are you telling yourself about these events today? What power and self-determination, if any, did you lose to this event if it was a negative event? If it was positive, what did you learn or gain? Our next age bracket includes the ages of 6 to 12. These are typically the school years when the teacher replaces the parent for the first time, and you have a lot of sibling types to cope with. Although you may have been top dog in your family, you may now have to prove yourself with this new group. Were there defining moments for you in these years? Look back at the 10 questions you wrote down for ages 1 through 5 and answer those same questions with reference to this age bracket. Having done that, now look back at the questions which addressed your current feelings and reactions to this event. Again, write as many different events as you can identify for this age bracket. Our next age group is 13 to 20. Turmoil and frustration often characterize the teenage years. This is when we learn about being an adult, breaking away from the family, and finding out what a big deal there is about sex. New motivations enter your life. Social relations become more important than food. There may be an acute sensitivity about whether you belong to the in crowd, however that group is defined for you. Love can be a major source of confusion. Forms of initiation or rites of passage may mark the struggle for adulthood. With varying degrees of focus and concern, your thoughts turn towards your future. Our next age group includes 21 to 38. This is typically the stage in which people begin their lives as citizens of the community and take on the responsibilities of jobs and families. We begin the task of learning how to be parents ourselves and how to become a partner in life. We are often confronted at this stage with our lack of knowledge on a number of fronts, such as power and self-discipline. The challenges we face may give us newfound admiration for our parents or for other role models we recall from childhood. Once again, identify as many defining moments from this category as possible and answer the two sets of questions we have discussed previously. Our next age group is 39 to 55. This age span is usually a time when you begin a new era of your life. You are usually settled into some vocation, and you have a pretty good idea of what life will offer you in the future. Wealthy or not, you may be living in a situation where you know you will be for a long time to come. You have done most of the things you needed to do in order to participate in the community. Now begins your time, the time in your life in which you can pay more attention to yourself. Allow your mind to travel over these years and once again see what defining moments arise. For each recollection, again, consider the two sets of questions that we have identified previously. Our last age category is 56 and beyond. While the age of 56 is by no means the end of life, for many this age brings thoughts of retirement from work and release from the responsibilities of the community and family. We begin to lose some physical vitality and are confronted with more limitations. Many of the defining moments in this stage of life emerge in the context of relationships, turning over responsibilities to others, and getting to know others in more intimate, less competitive ways. Once again, search this age bracket for those defining moments, and once identified, answer the two sets of questions that are now well known to you. Okay, we've now covered the different age brackets. Before you go on, look back over your writing. Examine the age brackets again and see if there might be a defining moment that you have overlooked or for some reason avoided talking about. Remember, monsters and ghosts work in the dark. This work that you're doing is designed to help you flip the switch and turn on the floodlights. If you have done an honest and thorough job of this exercise, you have defined some very important times of focus. You have identified moments that have been extremely important to your experience of life and to the development of your self-concept. These are the building blocks upon which all of your perceptions about life stand. Now is the time to link up your defining moments and see what emerges as the foundation of who you have become. Look at what you have written for your first defining moment. Come up with a title or summary statement of that defining moment, using one sentence or phrase. Mine might be called, "The Time Mrs. Johnson Chewed Me Out." Next, underneath each title, write just one short paragraph that captures the gist of what happened. Boil it down to its essence. You may end up with exactly 10 paragraphs, one each for your 10 defining moments. What matters is that you capture all of your most important life events. Now, for each defining moment, identify the before and after in your self-concept. What aspect or dimension of your self-concept was involved in or affected by that defining moment? Maybe it was your confidence. Maybe the defining moment had an impact on your sense of peace, your hope, ambition, joy, or love. Whatever dimension was affected, name it in writing. Then, for each dimension, write down where you think you were on that dimension, immediately before the defining moment occurred, and then after the defining moment occurred. In other words, if the defining moment affected your self-confidence, how were you different in your self-confidence before and after that defining moment? Think of these as before and after snapshots of one element of your self-concept. Let's use my example from the fifth grade. Before the event happened, I was a typical happy-go-lucky fifth grade kid. My approach was go along to get along. I was like a duck. If it didn't rain, I would walk. When it came to my need to protect myself and my ability to do so, I was totally ignorant. My thinking was I was just a kid. Adults, teachers, and parents took care of things like fairness and safety. By contrast, after my defining moment, I recognized that my imagined free lunch was over. I had both the obligation and the ability to self-protect. I could no longer expect others to do it for me, and what's more, I learned that standing up for myself and what I believed to be right would not always be real popular with those who were running an agenda that didn't include me and my interest. After I had been kicked out of school, and as I was escorted down the main hallway and out the front door, supposedly in shame, I was thinking, I did the right thing. I stood up and defended myself and my friends against some kids and adults who were in the wrong. I just got kicked out of school, but I'm not ashamed. I would do it again. Once you have an idea of the immediate before and after, it's time to write a paragraph to describe the long-term residual effect of each of those defining moments. Ask yourself how it has affected you long-term. What you're looking for here are aspects about yourself, qualities or lack of qualities that have developed as a direct consequence of an event. Your paragraph might begin, "As a result of this defining moment, I believe that I have lived my life with the tendency to be X, or with an approach to living that is governed by a self-concept that includes Y." Put some precise language around the parts of yourself you acquired as long-term consequences of the incident. In other words, how has it defined you across time? Then, write down how and why you think the defining moment either clarified or distorted your authentic self. As an example of the approach you might take here, I can tell you that my own experience in the fifth grade clarified for me that I was a good and decent person with a degree of courage about my convictions. It showed me that when the chips were down, I would do what I thought was the right thing. I had never really been down in the foxhole with myself before. I had never really had a test of character. That defining moment allowed me to sort of bond with the person who was me. For me, the event was negative, but the effect was positive. Finally, review your interpretation of and reaction to each defining moment. Decide whether or not you believe your interpretation was and is accurate or inaccurate. Were you really the victim you believed you were? Was the victory or loss or the outcome properly characterized by you to you? If you've been BSing yourself about this defining moment, now is the time to acknowledge that in writing. Your life demands choices. Day in and day out, someone or something is expecting you to make some decision. Choosing is a fact of life that you cannot escape. What do you want? Where do you want to go? Are you going to buy this car or that one? Should you just live together or take the plunge and get married? Should you tell your mother what Uncle Bill did to you when he visited last Christmas? Should you try drugs or just say no? Should you believe what the kids are saying about what happened? Is it time to put your mother in the home? Do you take this job or figure a way to stay home with the kids? Should you believe in God? Choices, 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 and no way to avoid them. If you're honest, you know there have been times when you have stepped right up and made certain choices with conviction and clarity. At other times, you chickened out and hoped someone else would just make the decision for you, simply because you didn't have the guts or the energy to face the pressure. What you may not have realized is that even in not choosing, you were in fact making a choice. No matter how fast you run, no matter how much you try to hide, you cannot not choose. Like everyone else in the real world, some of your choices have worked out really well, and some of them have proven to be total train wrecks. Unfortunately, all your choices, good or bad, have the power to be hugely significant in your life. The right to choose is both a burden and a privilege, and it all started at a very young age. At first, it's nothing more than, "Do I eat my peas and carrots?" All too soon, it becomes so very much more. As you get older, you carry a bigger stick in your life and that of those around you. Your choices count from day one, and that impact legally, morally, physically, financially, and socially does nothing but go up with age. Choices are a huge deal in how and why your life is what it is. That includes the ones you have made, whether young or old, and the ones you will make. In short, unlike your defining moments, some of which you had no control over, the choices you have made and will make in your life are 100% your responsibility. Some of these choices are absolute bell ringers that have changed your life in some monumental and lasting way. It's those choices that we must revisit and get real about. The challenge of this portion of the program is simply this. As with the defining moments that we talked about earlier, most of the choices you have made in life run together. They blur. We are faced with so many day-to-day routine decisions that it would be difficult for most people to list all the choices they had to make yesterday, let alone throughout their entire life. Nevertheless, as with your defining moments, there are a surprisingly small number of choices that actually rise to the level of being life-changing. I'm talking here about the seven most critical choices that have shaped your life, either positively or negatively. These seven critical choices have been major factors in determining who and what you have become. Identify and understand these choices, and you will unlock an amazing amount of information about you and your self-concept and you and your future. It is time to identify the various crossroads that you have encountered in your life. What choices you made at each, why you made the particular choice you did, and what you think have been the results for your life. What alternatives did you not choose, and what would have been the results of those alternatives? Finally, you need to recognize and distinguish choices you made for yourself versus those that you chose to have made for you. In approaching this task, and so that we can work with the information later, it may be useful for you to consider some of the whys behind your choices. What factors came into play when you were faced with a choice? When you start looking for your seven most critical choices, keep in mind that you, like all people, have various motivations or needs that drive each and every one of your choices. In fact, you are driven by a hierarchy of needs, such that unless and until a more basic need is met, you cannot and will not be motivated by the next level of need. Here, in ascending order, is a list of the hierarchy of needs. Survival, security, self-esteem, love, self-expression, intellectual fulfillment, and spiritual fulfillment. Notice that first among them is the need for your survival. Life itself must be protected before you will be motivated by any other need such as security, self-esteem, or love. This is important in understanding why you choose some of the things you choose and ignore some of the things you could have chosen. Let's examine each need or motivator. Survival. Regardless of whatever else was or is going on in your life, your most critical need is and always has been survival. It is the most basic of all instincts, and it is with this very powerful force that you first began your presence on Earth. Don't poo-poo this one. It is a big, big deal, because you start making choices and therefore getting shaped by the results of those choices from very early on. When first born, you were, of course, totally vulnerable. A community, in this case probably a family, hopefully valued you, protected you, and cared for you, but at a price. The price was that you had to conform to the values, patterns, and demands of that community to ensure that you would be embraced by them. You had to eat the way they did, behave the way they did, learn to speak their language, and accept and adapt to their environment. Think about how that early experience and the need to have the approval of others in order to peacefully survive may have carried over into other areas and choices of your adult life. It may well be that you learned to make choices based on whether or not the decisions and associated action would please others. Not please you, but please others. You may well have been conditioned to give your power away and make your own individual wants and needs secondary in determining the choices you would make, because you sensed or convinced yourself that conforming was essential to your very survival. Security. Once your survival needs are satisfied, the next level of need that can motivate your choices is the need to find some basis for emotional security in addition to your physical security. The number one emotional need for all people is the need for acceptance or belongingness. The emotional satisfaction that comes from external approval, from feeling that you are part of a couple, organization, or peer group. A possible downside to this need is that if it is predominant, and you feel that true individual expression might bring criticism or even rejection, you might very well choose conformity rather than expression. You may very well develop a pattern of ignoring your own thoughts and feelings instead opting to substitute someone else's judgment for your own because it meets your need for emotional security. Love. Studies of newborn babies show that unless we receive love, our survival is in jeopardy from the first days of our lives. As we grow up, if we are not convinced that we have it, we will go through life trying to find it. There is a certain way in which we need to be touched, held, and regarded behaviorally and emotionally. If we feel deprived, even from an early age, and before we have the vocabulary to describe it, we will be driven in our lives to find it. That drive can be so powerful as to dominate our thinking and motivations, and therefore our choices throughout life. Self-esteem. Once we have satisfied our survival needs, have attained a basic sense of security and feel loved, we relate our discussions about life to self-esteem. Unfortunately, most people haven't got the foggiest idea of what self-esteem is all about because they've been chasing after other people's versions, that is, external sources of esteem, all their lives. This craving for esteem, if it is measured by an external yardstick and/or worldly stuff, can be elusive, fickle, and as addictive as any drug. Research with adolescents has shown that consistently boosting kids' esteem externally, such as with random, just be positive praise, or a particular title or position in school is not a good idea. Children can end up as bottomless pits, continually trying to meet a need from the outside that can only be met from the inside. Simply put, if you don't love, believe in, and accept yourself, you will try to find someone else to do it for you. Seeking that validation so desperately from someone other than yourself can have a huge effect on the choices you make. Self-expression. Sooner or later, if we feel that our more fundamental needs have been met, we begin to start making choices based on the need to express the gifts that are uniquely ours. If we feel that our life is safe, our acceptances are secure, and we have the confidence and good self-acceptance and worth, we turn to more esoteric needs. We feel the urge to make our mark in the world. We may feel that we have to teach, train, design, or create. We may feel the need to write or draw or paint. We have to have children or travel the world to express ourselves. We make the choice to go into our own business rather than being just a number in some mega corporation. Driven by the need to be who we uniquely are, we may choose to be in the country with nature or in the city, shaking and baking in the business world. This need is so great in many people that they will renounce everything that is familiar and predictable, their jobs, their position in society, even their families, to write their novel or become an actor. The need for self-expression can be an enormous drive from within, prompting choices that often puzzle friends and family. Intellectual fulfillment. Choices in this area are driven by the desire for answers. The acquiring of knowledge, both general and specific, and the pursuit of answers to profound questions. As with the other needs in the hierarchy, once this level of functioning is met, it can become powerfully consuming. The search for an answer can consume the person and all of their choices can be driven accordingly. Some people, once other needs are met, just take a totally cerebral approach to life and their choices show it. When such is the case, choices are often one-dimensional. Spiritual fulfillment. Choices here are guided by a vision or goal beyond personal interest. Many regard this level of functioning as being highly actualized because it transcends everyday life as you make choices that are designed to deal with someone or something that you perceive as greater than yourself. You make choices that reflect that you realize that material and ego needs are often transient and may only be monetary. You order your decisions so that your spiritual needs, while difficult to measure by objective standards, are focused upon. Those with deep religious convictions would probably disagree with this pursuit being only at the top of the hierarchy. My response is that those with a deep spiritual focus, in the absence of well-met needs at the other levels, have transcended the worldly measure of whether those needs are met or not, and are in fact evolved in their choice-making. We don't begin life with the privilege and responsibility of making choices for ourselves. Typically, we don't even begin to differentiate ourselves from other living forms until the age of 2. Your dependence on your parents or other adult authorities means that during your crucial years of growth and learning, they were the people who made your choices for you. Questions about what to eat, what to wear, what your living environment would be like, and which schools you would attend were probably answered with little or no input from you. The adults in your life worked these things out, and they did so either with your interest in mind or not. They may have heavily influenced your choice of friends and your ultimate choice of career. In fact, if you had agreed to all the wants they wanted for you, you might still be busy helping them implement a long program of deciding the rest of your life. Too often, parents forget that one of the most important aspects of our growing up is learning how to make choices for ourselves. It is a skill to be learned and one that is exercised with confidence when the authentic self is the platform from which you make those choices. Sadly, letting others make our choices for us is a growth industry. The prospect of making a wrong choice can be so tough for some people, so frightening, that they will yield to other people their choice to choose. There are people who forfeit their power to a gang or a religious cult, where all decisions are dictated by a single leader. Psychic hotlines and spirit mediums generate huge profits from people's fears of making decisions on their own. In a variation on the same theme, some people dread leaving the military because they are terrified of the new choices they would face in civilian life. They have developed a comfort zone that equates contentment with being told what to do. Other people seek help from counselors or clergy, but then say to them in effect, "Tell me what to do with my life and I will obey." What I'm challenging you to do instead is take ownership of your own decision-making. Step 1, you can't change what you don't acknowledge, and acknowledging the most important choices that you've made so far in life is a crucial step towards positive change. Without this review, you will continue to make choices without any awareness of what is driving them or what you're setting yourself up for when you make the choice. This lack of awareness can only lead you still further from your authentic self because it denies the priorities that you have within you. Without knowledge of what you are and the choices that have led you to a fictional world-defined, parent or employee-defined existence, you are lost. By identifying your 7 critical choices, understanding why you made them and the results they led to in your life, you will gain important insight into who you have become in this life. Prepare to get real and get honest with yourself about the choices that have led you to where you are right now. There is no room for victim thinking here. We are dealing with life influences that you made through the choices and decisions you chose. As with the written exercises you did previously, you are about to do some recollecting. Remember what that means. You are recalling first an incident and second a result. In this case, the incident you should focus on is the particular choice that you made at a given time in your life. The result, the set of consequences that followed that choice, will be what lifts that decision to the status of a critical choice. Also, remember that choosing not to act is in itself a choice. That means that in taking stock of your critical life choices, you must keep a lookout for moments when a choice was called for and you chose not to act. As an example, a woman who tragically was molested as a child might need to acknowledge that she made a choice to conceal the fact. When she could have spoken up, she chose not to. Because that choice may have prolonged her pain, because it has so clearly affected her present self-concept, she has got to acknowledge it. You cannot change what you don't acknowledge. Another reminder. Your critical choices may certainly include positive decisions, moments whose consequences have affirmed or inspired you, and which continue to give you satisfaction today. These are the decisions about which you say, "You know, if I had to do it over again, I would do it exactly that way." So, what are the 7 choices that have most profoundly shaped your outlook on life? Let the following questions help you recollect. As in the previous exercise, I have grouped the questions in age brackets so the answers will be easier to remember. Likewise, I have set out some categories for you to consider as you reflect on your decisions during each period of life. Again, use your private journal here. Find a quiet spot that affords you some privacy, a comfortable place to sit, and some uninterrupted time to do the exercises. Here are the life dimensions or categories that I invite you to consider. Do not feel that you must restrict yourself to this list or that you must identify at least one critical choice in each dimension. Instead, simply let this list stimulate some ideas for you as you write. Make note of these questions because you will use them in each age category that we cover. Your critical choices may have occurred in the following areas or in others: personal life, physical life, professional life, family life, education, spiritual life, social life, and relationships. It may be helpful to take a look back at the material you wrote for the exercise concerned with your defining moments, since some of those defining moments may be directly linked with a critical choice. Let your defining moments lead you, as appropriate, to your critical choices. There may be some complete overlap here. In other words, a critical choice may well have turned out to be a defining moment. Okay, let's begin. For each of the age brackets mentioned previously, ages 1 through 5, 6 through 12, 13 through 20, 21 through 38, 39 through 55, and 56 and beyond, consider the question, was this age bracket one in which I made a critical choice? If so, answer the following questions. What was the choice? Write a sentence that describes it. Example, when I was 18, I chose to get married and go to work. Why did you make the choice? Write a paragraph that explains what prompted you to make the choice. Identify as many factors as you can recall. Feel free to use the list of needs we covered earlier. As an example, this paragraph might start out with something like, "I thought I was in love. I had never done particularly well in school, and my family didn't have much money, so college just didn't look like an option to me then. Working at the plant looked like real security. I got big self-esteem from being able to buy a new pickup truck and move into my own apartment. I liked being liked by the supervisor and envied and admired by my high school friends." What alternatives did you give up by making this choice? Write a paragraph that describes what the cost of the choice was. Example, by going straight to work, I was choosing not to go to college. By getting married, I was giving up the opportunity to date other people, and so on. Obviously, there may be a certain amount of speculation involved here, but do the best you can to examine what might have been, had you not made the choice that you did. Where were you in terms of your self-concept immediately before this choice, and what was your self-concept after this choice? In other words, if the critical choice affected your self-esteem, how were you different in your self-esteem before and after that critical choice? What aspect or dimension of your self-concept was involved in or affected by that choice? Write those observations down and be completely honest. Write a paragraph to describe the long-term residual effect of the critical choice. How has this critical choice affected you long-term? Again, what you're looking for here are aspects about yourself that have developed as a direct consequence of that choice. Your paragraph might begin, "As a result of my critical choice to get married and go to work, I believe that I expected everything to come easy to me after that." I made no effort to come up with a safety net for the possible loss of my job, and I started living on assumptions. I became financially irresponsible, believing that the job would always be there for me and that I could continue to expect increases in pay. My expectations for my own life got narrower and narrower. Let your writing speak to the consequences of your choice. How